This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Dan Savage, author, media pundit, journalist, newspaper editor. He writes the internationally syndicated relationship and sex advice column, Savage Love. In his latest book is American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Also on the show, the venerable political consultant, Gus Weil. He'll look at Governor Bobby Jindal in year number 6 of the Jindal administration. Gus Weil worked with many governors in the past, and there will be some comparisons. And also, one of the first clients for Mr. Gus Weil was then U.S. Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Today is the 96th anniversary of the birth of the 35th American president. All this, but first the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jessica Kane producing today. Your numbers 297-5633. If you're dialing locally and outside the area, 877-217-5757. Our leadoff guest, Dan Savage, the author of the internationally syndicated sex advice column Savage Love and the editorial director of The Stranger, Seattle's weekly newspaper. And in addition to frequent appearances on CNN, MSNBC, Real Time with Bill Maher, and The Colbert Report, Dan Savage is a regular contributor to NPR's This American Life. His books include the New York Times bestseller, It Gets Better, The Commitment, Skipping Towards Gomorrah, and The Kid, his award-winning memoir about adoption. He lives in Seattle with his husband, Terry, and their son, DJ. His latest book, American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Good morning, Dan Savage.
Good morning.
Nice to hear your voice. Well, let's begin with same-sex marriage. Are you waiting with interest regarding the Supreme Court and the decision that should be forthcoming soon?
Absolutely. My husband and I are particularly interested in that decision. We were kind of trapped by the new law. One of the things the federal government does is if you are a legally married same-sex couple in a state where same-sex marriage is legal, your taxes are all screwed up. We were required to file as community property because the federal government says you're married, but we weren't allowed to file jointly because the federal government says we're not married. And consequently, our tax bill was the size of our son's college education. Potential college education, our tax head. We have a special right to basically being doubly taxed, a tax at a rate that no opposite-sex married couple would be taxed at. So, you know, depending on the Supreme Court decisions this June, this could have real consequences for us and our family and our son and his future.
Do you have any feel on how the Supreme Court may rule?
All signs point toward them scrapping DOMA as unconstitutional. The federal government has never really meddled in the states and their definitions of marriage. For instance, first cousins are allowed to marry in some states, not allowed to marry in other states, but the federal government doesn't refuse to recognize first cousin marriages to protect the delicate sensibilities of the states where those marriages are not recognized. This was really an intrusion on the federal government's part into marriage, which had always been the deal of the states. So it looks like DOMA may fall. The other case before the Supreme Court was the Prop 8 decision.
Right.
And they could do a broad ruling that would legalize, that was an equal protections argument under the 14th Amendment. And they could uphold the lower court rulings and then basically legalize same-sex marriage in all 50 states. Some people are comparing that to a Roe v. Wade, that would kick off such a backlash that we would have 40 years of fighting about it, and perhaps an effort to pass a constitutional amendment. So, writers like Andrew Sullivan, who's been really the leader, intellectual leader of the fight for same-sex marriage rights in the United States for 25 years, have said that their preference, the preference is for scrapping DOMA and allowing the states to continue to hash this out case by case, state by state. And we've been winning ever since last November in the states. Three states in November, Maine, mm-hmm. Maryland, and Washington, approved same-sex marriage at the ballot box. And we've had three states since then approve same-sex marriage through their state legislatures. And now Illinois looks like it may go this week, too, and approve same-sex marriage. So, you know, the genius of federalism, the laboratory of the state, seems to be working in our favor.
Dan Savage is the guest, the author of American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. Now, you comment on many issues of the day in the book, including assault weapons. You believe they should be banned. Why so?
Because, oh my gosh, because we don't need military weapons in the hands of individuals. People don't need a gun that can mow down 25 and 6-year-olds in a minute and a half to protect their families or their homes. We don't allow people to own bazookas or other military-grade weapons or tanks or nuclear weapons. There are already restrictions on the kinds of arms that you can bear, and I think that those arms are, you know, the right to them is just insane. When they wrote the Second Amendment, about a well-regulated militia, by the way, and not every individual gun owner is a well-regulated militia unto himself, they were talking about muskets. The Founding Fathers could not have foreseen the kind of weaponry available to the average American citizen now. And I don't think that a safe and rational society allows the kind of proliferation of guns that we allow. And this idea that we need to be armed to protect ourselves from the federal government is just crazy. And, you know, it feeds that paranoid strain in American culture. And the 30,000 gun deaths a year in this country, you know, look at how we've ramped up against terrorism after 3,000 people were murdered in Lower Manhattan, where I'm talking to you from right now. You know, we pulled out all the stops to make sure that was unlikely to happen again on our soil. Meanwhile, every year since 9/11, 30,000 Americans have died as a result of gun violence. The disconnect, the willingness to put up with these deaths is just insane. And in the last couple of weeks, we've seen all these 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds shooting each other, shooting their parents, finding loaded guns in their house. Guns don't make us safer. Guns make us less safe.
But, Dan, you have said that you believe guns should be allowed, in fact, assault weapons, in the U.S. Capitol. Are you serious?
Well, I'm making sort of a, you know, Swiftian point there. You have state legislatures and the federal government, the Congress, making it legal to carry any type of weapon into churches, national parks, into your workplace and my workplace, at the same time that you are not allowed to carry those guns into Congress. If someone should be allowed to open carry or conceal carry an assault weapon into where I work every day, why don't the same rules apply to Congress? Why can't you carry an assault rifle into the observation gallery at the U.S. Senate? If that's a fine thing for someone to carry into a church, a national park, a Walmart, a school, why can't I carry that into the Senate? Why gun control for them but no one else? Which is basically what we have. We have a gun control bubble that protects the people who make the laws that leave the rest of us vulnerable. And that's not fair. So if guns are fit for my workplace, they should be fit for Congress's workplace.
Now, many of your admirers like the way you take issues and turn them upside down, and one of those is you believe straight people should have straight pride parades. How would this work?
Well, I believe straight people do have a straight pride parade. You know, I do a lot of speaking at colleges, and often someone will stand up, a straight kid will stand up and say, why do gay people have to have parades and make such a big deal about their sexuality? You don't see straight people having straight pride parades. And my answer is always, well, I wish I did. I think you should have straight pride parades. Not straight supremacy pride parades, not straight is better than gay. And gay pride parades are not gay is better than straight. That's not what they're about. Gay people aren't proud of the simple fact that we are gay. The pride parade is about taking, you know, reclaiming this thing that we were told was sick and sinful and shameful, you know, the fact of our sexual orientations, and saying, no, this is something good about our lives, something we're proud of, and we're proud of having overcome the bigotry, the hatred, the isolation, the fear to live really fully realized adult lives. That's what the Pride Parade is about. It's that struggle, that successful struggle that we're proud of, not the fact of our sexuality. But there is this aspect of the Pride Parade where people are kind of celebrating their sexual expression. You know, there's some excess in the pride parade, in gay pride parades. And straight people need that, too. And a lot of cultures have that for straight people. You see in Brazil with Carnival, New Orleans has Mardi Gras, fashing in German-speaking countries, which is their Carnival, where people go out of the streets in appalling outfits and sort of just let loose for a day, for a parade, and celebrate their sexuality in a way where they're just, you know, we're all buttoned up most of the time and all, like, polite society, polite discourse, proper behavior in public requires you to sort of move through the world pretending you're not thinking about sex all the time, when you actually are, most of us are, including straight people. And so to have that one day a year where you can go out in public and say, yeah, I'm a sexual person, I'm a sexual being, I think about sex a lot, and just let go, that's good. That's good for gay people. One of the things that Gay Pride Parade is good at is just like letting it all hang out for one day and just kind of cutting loose. And straight people need that kind of release too. And I argued that people keep talking about Halloween now with the sexy Halloween costumes and the pub crawls, and now more money is spent on Halloween costumes for adults than for children. There's this huge multi-billion-dollar industry now that sort of turned Halloween into this kind of celebration of sexual expression for straight people. And the irony is that Halloween used to be the gay national holiday before Pride came along. And the Pride Parade celebrating the Stonewall Riots in June kind of took over for Halloween. Halloween traditionally had been the one day a year that gay people could go out in drag, that lesbians could go out, you know, in tuxedos, dressed as men, if that's what they wanted to do, without being arrested. And it was the gay holiday. And now it's kind of the straight holiday, where straight people go out and, you know, wear dirty costumes and get a little drunk and let it all hang out. And I think that's good, and I think straight people need that release.
You say Obamacare is on the whole a good thing, but is still, I'm quoting you, kind of evil. How so?
Well, I was for single payer and family single payer, at least a public option. People are still going to fall through the cracks with Obamacare. It isn't going to be universal coverage. People will still be bankrupted by medical bills. One of the things that was not reported enough or a lot of volume during the debate over health care reform was the fact that 75% of the people who are bankrupted by medical bills have health insurance. And so just making private health insurance more widely available isn't going to protect people from the kind of ruin that our system inflicts upon people. We need single payer. We need universal health care. We need Medicare for all. That would not be evil. That's what most Western rich democracies have for their citizens. And Obamacare does not provide that. It's going to extend coverage to more people, and that's a good thing. 17,000 plus Americans die every year for lack of access to health care, for not having health care coverage, according to a study by research at Harvard University. And so there will be fewer deaths, but there will still be misery inflicted on people and ruination inflicted on people, because what Obamacare is really kind of a Rube Goldberg contraption, Paul Krugman in the New York Times calls it, that benefits the private health insurance industry, that brought us all of the abuses that Obamacare was designed in some respects to address. And the idea that the healthcare industry won't come up with new abuses is crazy. It will come up with new abuses. So I just don't, I think it's a good and positive step. But it is the lesser of two evils, but the lesser of two evils is still evil.
Stephen writes, he says, for a gay man, Dan, you know a lot about heterosexual relationships. Certainly you write about them. When it comes down to relationships, is there really a big distinction between straight couples and gay couples?
There's some distinctions. You know, gay culture, gay male culture is an all-male culture, and you do see some differences when you compare gay couples to straight couples to lesbian couples. You know, gay couples are less likely to be monogamous than straight couples are, and straight couples are less likely to be monogamous than lesbian couples are, which tells us not something about gay men, but something about men. So you do see some distinctions, but when it comes to love and commitment, and fidelity and loyalty, there really is no difference. And the feeling in the heart, that desire for intimacy in a partner, all of that is exactly the same.
The book is American Savage from Dan Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. And Dan, and he's, of course, making the rounds. This book is the talk of the nation. There was a question, are you any kin to Michael Savage?
I'm an actual Savage from the actual Savage family from Rogers Park, north side of Chicago. Michael Savage.
He's a fake Savage. He's a faker.
Yeah, his real last name is Wiener, and he took Savage as his professional name. I'm Savage born and bred, Savage raised. Mom and Pa Savage and Grandma and Grandpa Savage.
Well, thank you, Dan. Congratulations on another fine work. American Savage from Dan Savage. And we shall return with Gus Weil after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. And our guest is Gus Weil, the well-known political consultant who's been doing his thing for 55 years, and he still opines quite eloquently on American and Louisiana politics. He's back home in his home state, and we're with him on, appropriately, the 96th anniversary of the birth of the 35th American president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. You knew him before he was president, didn't you, Gus?
Yes, I did. I remember an extraordinary day. The late Camille Gravel invited several of us he had some tickets to a Democratic Party fundraiser in Washington. And he said that the next day we would go out to the house of this young United States senator from Massachusetts, a fellow named Kennedy. So we went to the dinner that night, very nice. And the next day we went out to Georgetown, very old section of Washington. And there in a red brick house was Jackie and John F. Kennedy. And I recall as the day wore on that a nurse came in holding Caroline, who was just a baby, and introduced her. And last time I saw Jacqueline Kennedy that day, we had stepped out of the house, and she was walking down the street. It was kind of getting dark, and leaves were falling. And I remember she was hugging herself against the cold. It had turned cold.
Hmm.
But what a music thing that happened. Kennedy was the furniture in the house. When we left, Judge Reggie from Crowley asked me what I think about the house. And I said I was shocked, frankly. He said, why? I said, well, I've never seen such old furniture. Looks like those people would buy some new furniture with all their money. And he said, you fool, that's French antiques. Worth a fortune.
Well, has there ever been anyone close to Kennedy as far as his magnetism and charisma? He's been dead now 50 years almost, longer dead than he was alive, but certainly the legacy of Camelot endures to this day.
Oh, I don't think we'll ever see anybody like him, not in the next few years. All of the presidents after him have been kind of regular guys, good men, a lot of them. But there was something almost, you're right, majestic or mystical about the Kennedys. I think that it was the combination of their fame, their wealth, and their tragedy, because you kind of held your breath that they were going to have some horrific ending, and just about all of them did. That's really something.
Mm-hmm.
How they were doomed. It was kind of like Irish folklore. There was a doom about them. Kennedy was a nice man to talk to. He wasn't president. He was a little different. And then the next time I met him, Judge Reggie brought him to Crowley for the Rice Festival. And I had a little public relations on that, and that was very interesting. He came in this private family plane, which I met in the airport in Lafayette, and a bunch of young fellas got off the plane, and mm-hmm. we all shook hands. And all those young fellas, as I called them, became famous. There was P.S. Salinger, and what was the name of the man? His speechwriter?
Ted Sorensen.
Ted Sorensen. And all of those guys who were on that family plane, as I say, became renowned from their association with him. Now, Ted Sorensen became a close friend. And when I lived in New York recently, I used to eat with him once a week. We'd have lunch. And he passed away only a few months later.
He was on this show shortly before he died, and what an elegant man. He was the real deal. And he also said that Kennedy wrote that inaugural address. Do you believe him, or was he?
No, I don't.
You don't think
He it was a secret that he would. I asked him when we were together so much, and I asked him, I said, Ted, did you write that talk, or particularly the part about ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country? And he said, I'll never tell. I said, okay.
Okay.
He was almost blind, incidentally.
Yep.
When I towards the end, he had had, a stroke.
297-5633, if you'd like to talk with Gus Weil, once the host for many years of Louisiana Legends on Louisiana Public Broadcasting, and he is a Louisiana legend and has been recognized as such, member of the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame, the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame. He was my commencement speaker when I graduated from LSU on August 7th, 1981, and Gus has been doing this for 55 years. His clients have varied from those in politics at local levels, state levels, national levels, to people like Jimmy Lee Swaggart. He's handled just about everybody who's been somebody in Louisiana over the last half century. Now, Gus Weil, President Kennedy, when he was elected, he was 43 years old.
Yes.
Second youngest president and the youngest elected ever. Bobby Jindal in 2016 will be 45. There's very little doubt he will be running for president. Does he have the Kennedy-esque magnetism to win the White House?
I'm afraid not. I hate to disappoint his multitude of followers, but I don't see anything for him in the future at a national level, unless a Republican is elected president, and then Jindal may join
the cabinet
as maybe Secretary of Education, something like that, but he hasn't done a real good job here in Louisiana. So, no, I don't see much of a political future.
You've been back a few years now, so you've seen this governor in a more intimate way than you did when you were in New York. What's your read on how he's doing?
Well, my read is that we are a very troubled state. Two examples. We lead the nation in unwed mothers. Very serious problem. We lead the nation in the disease AIDS. And if ever there are problems that cry out for full-time management or handling or solving or even attacking, it's those problems and this state. And I don't think that being governor is even the number one thing on his agenda. I think it's running for president. Every time he leaves this state, I just thank goodness we have a real great lieutenant governor. And because otherwise, I don't know what we would do.
Well, in 2015, a year before Bobby Jindal runs for president, most likely, there will be a host of candidates running for governor. You've seen this happen before. Anytime a seat is open, especially the governor's office,
You
have a mad dash to see who's going to be the state's chief executive. And we'll have some well-known names, including Jay Darden, John Bell Edwards, who announced on this show, says he's in, and others are likely to join, including U.S. Senator David Bruce Vitter. If David Vitter wins, will that say something good or bad about the state?
It'll say that we learned nothing from having Jindal, because Vitter is, I've never seen him champion anything. I've only seen him as an obstructionist in the United States Senate, and he's so far to the right. He's to the right of the Tea Party. I, on the other hand, Darden is a top man, and I don't know. I think he may be our governor.
Donald at LSU. Good morning, Donald.
Hello.
You're on the air with Gus.
Hello, Mr. Gus. I want to thank you. I really appreciate your knowledge of Louisiana history, and I love Louisiana history with all the famous governors we've had, from Huey Long to Edwin Everett, even Dave Treen. But my question is, the situation with Bayou Corn, I've watched it very, very closely, and I've almost anticipated the outcome all the way down to these bogus settlements now. And it seems that Governor Jindal has been absent from the state, one, but absent from being attentive to those people's needs. This is a national environmental disaster. And there aren't no answers. And I really believe the people have been too complacent with Governor Jindal up until this month about their property, about what's going on, and why it happened, and why it was not monitored properly.
What about Bayou Corn in the sinkhole, Gus?
That's got to be not a national but an international disgrace. Almost every week since I've been back in Louisiana, which is a little more than a year, they've been talking about the Bayou Corn sinkhole, and that I think they finally had to demand or plead with the governor to go and look at it. And when I think of the governors whom I've either worked with or known, my goodness, that would have been the number one problem for a governor to attack. But I don't know if he's done anything. I know he's been and looked at it, I think. But that's about it. And that sinkhole, we're the only state in the nation, I can assure you. And I can assure our caller, who will still be fooling with that, not having solved it.
Mm-hmm.
To govern a state, a lot of the problems have to do with little people. That's us. To govern a state, you've got to love a state. And you've got to be willing to get down in the trenches, in the mud, in the soil, in the clay in North Louisiana. And I don't see that fervor, that passion in Governor Jindal at all. For example, I would think that when he leaves office, I would bet, and I'm not a betting man, I would bet that he doesn't even live in Louisiana. He'll probably come back.
He'll be living at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, won't he?
I don't think he'll be living there, but he'll be with maybe some think tank, or as I said, in a Republican presidential cabinet. I think he'll be there, but he couldn't. He has not left this state in better shape than he found it.
All right. Well, here's a question, and a good one from Annie. She says that David Treen loved the state as much or more than any governor, and he was as honest as any governor before or since. And yet he's been regarded as not such a good governor. So sometimes detachment might be a good thing. Do you really have to be in the state 365 days a year to be doing your job?
No, but you've got to be here a lot. You can't be gone at least once a month. Particularly in this state, there are so many problems. Any place you look in Louisiana, we are at the bottom of a list in every endeavor. And these problems cry out to be tended to. And that's what we have a governor for and a legislature for and an educational system for. And Treen was a good man. I knew it. I worked for Treen, and he was a very fine man. He was not a colorful man. He was a very bland person. I'll tell you a little story about Dave Treen. I was in his office once, and he gave his secretary, I remember a young lady, $10. And I looked, and I said, "Governor, may I ask you what is your secretary doing with that $10? He said, "She's going to buy me some stamps for my personal mail." And I couldn't get over that. He was that honest.
Buying his own stamps.
Oh, yeah, and you know, that's unheard of.
Well, he bought his own stamps. He didn't cheat on his wife.
No.
There were no scandals involving him personally.
And he could not have been reelected.
Well, he got crushed, even though you were helping him. You and Roy Fletcher were out there doing your best.
Could not have been reelected. He ran against perhaps the greatest politician in the history of Louisiana, right up there with the late Huey Long and John McKiffin. He ran against Edwin Edwards. And Edwards, in a political campaign, was pure genius. He really was. He was a genius. It's what he did best.
Oh, yeah. And he's still Edwin Edwards, and he still lights up a room when he walks in. And he's soon to be a father again at the age of 86. He's 6 years older than you, Gus. What do you think?
I didn't know there was anybody 6 years older than me. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, there may be time for you to
Well, you know, it sort of sets me thinking. That's what I need. But he is a really brilliant man. He's a flawed man, but he's a brilliant man.
Aren't we all flawed?
Yeah, but we're not all governor of a sovereign state.
And one thing about Edwards, he was never a hypocrite.
No. And in this state, it was his most wonderful quality. Mm-hmm. We liked to laugh, and and he made us laugh. He was so brilliant. I remember I was handling his campaign, and we went to a television station to make a TV spot, and we never even discussed the spot. He said, "Gus, how long do I talk?" I said, "Governor, it's a 30-second spot, so I guess you ought to talk about 28 seconds. He said, "And on what subject?" I might have said education. He said, "Let's go do it." And we turned on the cameras, and he gave us exactly 28 perfect seconds. So that was his strength. His main weakness, he had some of the worst people in the history of politics working for him. Not all of them. He had some fine people. But, boy, he had some losers.
Well, he vetoed a concealed carry bill when he was governor. Claire notes that a bill that has made its rounds and is likely to go to the governor's desk and be signed by Bobby Jindal now will have a lifetime concealed carry permit. So you get it at 21, you can have it when you're 86, like Edwin Edwards.
Isn't that wonderful? What an accomplishment.
Well, do you have a permit, Gus?
The last time I owned a weapon was when I was in military intelligence, and I then carried a .38. And that's the last time that I had a weapon.
But you were in military intelligence. Most of these people touting guns, they've never served in the military. Some of course have, but people like Governor Jindal, for example, Senator Vitter, they've never been in the military.
No. And I'm all for people who hunt having the right to have weapons, rifles, shotguns. That's an American tradition.
297-5633. We'll return with Gus Weil. Go back to the phone lines when we come back after 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jessica Kane producing today. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, for Gus Weil in our remaining moments with him. Daryl in Glen Oaks. Good morning, Daryl. You're on with Gus.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest what he felt about Mary Landrieu's prospects of winning re-election with the well-funded Republicans that are lining up against her. What do you think about her chance? And that's that was my question.
I've never been a big Mary Landrieu supporter, although I knew her father, the late Mayor Moonlight.
Well, he's still around.
Of New Orleans. And she, I think, has been a pretty good senator. And she represents the people. And I can't imagine her getting beaten right now by any of the candidates who've been mentioned.
Well, Bill Cassidy is going to run the Congress.
I've never met the gentleman, you know. And I was thinking a moment ago when we were off the air about the concealed weapons. Why would we, in a civilized state, in the year 2013, why would we need a concealed weapon? Who is it being concealed from? I guess if I was going to rob a bank, I would conceal my weapon. But otherwise, or murder someone. But I can't imagine what I'd do with a concealed weapon. And a bunch of people with a concealed weapon, particularly around alcohol or narcotics, which is so prevalent in our society, seems to me it's just a tinder waiting to explode.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Gus Weil. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Weil.
Good morning, sir.
Just a couple things. I know that there are some really good people out there that don't run for office because it can get so nasty. And I believe Ms. McKithen, I think Marjorie McKithen, would probably be out there, and I think she would be a good candidate. And what I would really, really like to see is if you and Mr. Roy Fletcher would get together on the same stage and just have all night long question and answer reminiscence about
you're a real political nut, I can tell.
Roy Fletcher started with you, didn't he?
Yes, he started with me. Just about everybody in the political business, public relations business, started with me. There was no such industry when I started, and most of them started. Roy did, and of course he's been tremendously successful. And
James
he's a good
Carville,
man.
Mr. Carville.
James Carville, yeah, I'll never forget James Carville's opening words to me. He came to see me and he said, "I am a shyster lawyer." And I said, "I beg your pardon." And Carville said, "I'm a shyster lawyer and I want to get in your profession, this political public relations." And I took him on, and he was so much smarter than me, it wasn't even funny.
Leonard Joseph asks Gus, and that's what I'm doing, why the people of Louisiana elected Governor Jindal two times.
I think that it was it was the result of people being so turned off by the prior administrations that I think it was a vote of protest against much of the Edwards administration. I think they had found what they thought was the most important quality, honesty. And it is not the most important quality. You can be the best man from an honest standpoint and do nothing except prove to people how honest you are, or in Jindal's case, how disinterested you are.
Well,
I remember when Jindal had this fabulous opportunity to give the Republican response to the president, the president's
State of the Union.
State of the Union, and I listened, and boy, here was his chance. He had the whole nation transfixed, and it was a schoolboy speech. It's the kind of speech you used to give at the seventh grade in Lafayette High School, and I almost fainted. I really did.
Well, I noted the other day that over the weekend it was reported that the Golden State of California has a $4.4 billion surplus this year. Jerry Brown, who was elected governor in 2010, inherited a huge deficit, an incredible mess in California from his predecessor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, sir.
And he has righted the ship in California. Now, Governor Jindal inherited a billion-dollar surplus, and now we're scrambling for every dollar we can to patch the budget holes. Should he ask Jerry Brown, 75 years young, to come to Louisiana for kind of a tutorial, maybe a seminar on how to balance budgets and get surpluses? Would that be a good idea?
I don't think he needs Jerry Brown. I think that he could put together a group of 5 or 10 people here, men and women, and from various walks of life and persuasions and ethnic groups, and in a frank, open discussion, which a governor has difficulty having, because people tell him what they think he wants to hear. I think that he could get a lot of good ideas, but he's so frozen in to this far, far right that I don't think anybody could penetrate him with ideas.
Jason on Jones Creek. Jason, you're on the air with Gus Weil. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Yes, Mr. Weil, I have a question for you. I guess it's just to satisfy my own curiosity. When I was a boy here, we used to get the State Times. It's a local newspaper in Baton Rouge.
Yes.
And there was a column in there, and I guess it was titled Grassroots Gus. Are you Grassroots Gus?
Or no, and I got the credit, but I never was him.
Okay, I was always curious about that.
I used to get asked that all the time. And when he gave hell to somebody, I'd catch it. Somebody say, oh, you shouldn't have said that. You went way over the line. And I stopped denying it because nobody believed me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I saw today the Advocate hired another prominent Picayune employee. It seems like every day there's a new announcement. Two well-known columnists, Stephanie Grace and James Gill, are now writing for the Advocate. There's a new owner, John Georges. What do you think about this newspaper war that's going on?
Well, first of all, the Manships have got to be among the luckiest people in the world to have sold their paper for, I'm sure, several millions of dollars. And I don't see any change in the paper. I like it, you know, and it remains a good paper. But I don't see any radical changes in it.
Is the Picayune on life support, or is there life remaining for the New Orleans newspaper?
Well, that's the strangest story journalistically of all. I've never heard of that, you know. Never in my experience have I heard of a newspaper cutting its issues, a number of issues, and for quotation marks, city, close quotation marks. It really was astonishing.
Steve Winham, the former budget director under Buddy Romer, fine man, he writes, Jim, I wonder if Gus will agree on this up to and including the general administration, our hopes have been dashed so consistently and for so long, most Louisianians have simply given up. Our culture is becoming less laissez la bon temps rouler, but more laissez-faire. More people seem more unhappy with the state of our state than ever in recent history. Maybe things will get so bad we will collectively recognize change as a practical necessity and unite to demand it, creating a cultural revolution, if you will. It is ironic that our ineffective leaders could then lay legitimate claim to being the catalysts of positive change.
Gee, that's an intelligent letter, and I must tell you, I agree with him. I couldn't say it that well, but I agree with the gentleman.
So in 2015, you seem to think that Jay Darden has a good shot of winning.
Oh, I think he's going to be your governor. And I think he'll be a total... I don't know him well. I've met a lieutenant governor maybe three times. And there's nothing flashy about him. I'm told he's a brilliant man. Of course, we got that. But he's got... I think he's got some ideas. And I don't think he's locked into these medieval philosophy that we're now being subjected to.
He is a strong conservative, though. There's no doubt that he is in accord with most of the Republicans. He supported, and I'm sure, Mitt Romney and backed David Vitter, even though those two are right now potential rivals. But he votes Republican. Next time he's on this show, a good question for Jay Darden would be, when was the last time he voted for a Democrat? But does it really matter, as governor, if a person is a strong leader and open to new ideas?
It really doesn't matter. If you're open to new ideas, and if you don't surround yourself with people who are part of the choir, so to speak, and let in some sunlight, you can do very well. I've never heard of Darden being locked in. I think he'd probably be the best governor that we've had in a long time.
Lastly, a listener notes that on this show a few days ago, Jay Darden said that if the legislature passed a bill to repeal the Louisiana Science Education Act, which was sponsored by a Democrat, Ben Nevers, by the way, if the legislature did that, that Jay Darden would sign the bill to repeal, but that he would not lead the effort to repeal. This basically allows the alternate theories to the theory of evolution to be taught in public schools in our state. What do you make of that?
A politician has to say all kind of things to be elected and then to stay in office. And sometimes they're the furthest thing from his actual beliefs. But the art of politics is the art of compromise. And in this state, it's unbelievable, but there are many people who are against Darwinism. It's not a surprise that a politician would not talk about that a lot. Well, I mean, think of it. We had Jindal for 4 years, and we re-elected him. What does that say about us? It's almost like we're an unconscious population.
Well, Gus Weil, thank you for joining us today, and let's talk again soon.
Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. 297-5633 is your number. We're joined in our remaining time this hour by Stephen Angel. He's president, founder, and creator of Drumming for Your Life Institute, the reading and rhythm program bringing back the joy of teaching for teachers and the excitement of learning for students. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Stephen, you started this voyage in life with Jimi Hendrix many years ago, didn't you?
I did. I recorded with him when I was 16 years old.
16, and you're 54 now?
I'm 59.
59. Okay, so we're talking 43 years ago. Well, yeah, it'd have to be. Jimmy, yeah. You were with him right before he died then.
Exactly. Yeah, it was March of 1970.
Well, how did that experience shape your life?
Well, it did, because the thing about Jimmy was that I always thought that he found what I call the crack into the universe for him, you know, what was uniquely special for him. And that was really powerful. I mean, he took the guitar to a level of this extraordinary power. And so I found that inspiring.
And you started playing on bongo drums at the age of 3, watching Ricky Ricardo on I Love Lucy, didn't you?
That's right. I used to play along with the show when my parents would have parties at night.
And I'm told that your first performance was at the age of 6 with a guy named Buddy Rich.
Exactly. Yeah, I sat in with his band when I was 6 years old. And the only thing I really remember was how big the drums were. They were huge.
He had amazingly strong hands, didn't he?
Yes.
You didn't want to shake hands with Buddy Rich.
Right. He did have strong hands, because I met him again when I was around 13. I remember his hands, very long, strong hands. And Hendrix had really long, big hands, too.
Well, as a musician, that's probably a good thing. But well, tell us about the power of rhythm and your program that I initiated the conversation with you about. You're doing things involving drums that nobody before you has done.
Well, we're using rhythm in the classroom. There's no drums actually involved. The kids play on folders and books, and the teacher, while they're reading, the teacher's the only one that's playing the rhythm. They play rhythms before they read, but when they're actually reading, only the teacher plays the rhythm. She usually plays on a book, or he plays on a book, and it's just one rhythm that he plays, and we use different tempos, and it's to improve focus and concentration, to move all the distractions from the room, and really heighten the learning experience for the student.
Do you have evidence that it's working?
We do have evidence. We've been doing this. This is our 12th year. We've pre- and post-tested over 3,000 students. We have a 50% increase in their reading scores just in 6 weeks when we use it as an after-school program, which we do a lot in Southern California. And now we're training teachers in different parts of the world, actually. We were just in London. We were in just Massachusetts, and so we're expanding the program and training teachers. You don't need any musical experience, which is really great to know how to do this, and you can become really excellent at it without any musical experience.
Well, for those who'd like to know more about what you're doing as the founder and creator of Drumming for Your Life Institute and the Reading and Rhythm Program, how can we find out more, Stephen?
Our website is dfyl.org. It's drummingforyourlife.org. We have a film on there that was recently on PBS, and you can take a look at that. We have a lot of test scores and testimonials. And I always say, if you have a school that you really care about, bring a program out there. Let us help the students who are struggling and get their reading scores up in a very short amount of time.
Stephen, and a listener, John in New Roads, notes that famous drummer Ed Shaughnessy,
yes,
from the Tonight Show. Yeah, he died yesterday. So
wow.
Yeah. So there you go. There's a true music legend.
Yeah, yeah, he was a great big band drummer. You know.
Who is your favorite?
I have four favorites. I have Buddy Rich, Gene Krupa, who I also played with, and Tony Williams, who played with Miles Davis for many years, and Elvin Jones, who was John Coltrane's drummer for many years. And I would say those four were my...
What does it take to be a great drummer?
It takes a combination of things. You have to have the technique, but that's only a small piece of it. It's really the passion and the connection, how deeply connected you are to the drum. I always said I never played the drum. I played inside the drum. I played the soul of the drum.
Well, thank you, Stephen Angel, and congratulations on the Reading and Rhythm program. And we thank you for listening today. For Jessica Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.